love the Netflix show. And I was like, oh, thanks so much. He's like, yeah, yeah, I really liked the episode you did on Supreme. I was like, what? I didn't do no episode on Supreme. And then I quickly realized he's talking about Hasan Minhaj. Patriot Act. Different show, different guy. And he felt horrible, right? And he immediately realized his mistake, and he was trying to buy it back. He's like, oh, no, Aziz, right? I was like, yeah, yeah, that's me. Master of None, yeah, yeah, that's me. Parks and Rec, yeah, yeah, that's me. Treat Yourself, yeah, yeah, that's me. And you had that whole thing last year, sexual misconduct. No. That was Hasan.
So that was Aziz Ansari. And as we sit here...
Is he sorry or isn't he?
And as we sit here about to do this podcast, the news just came over that the Netflix special, he addresses his Me Too concerns, which is not in the trailer, but we do want to watch that and see what he has to say about that. I'm Neil Rosen. Welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies. We were off last week for the July 4th holiday. I'm joined, as always, by Bill Brigoli.
And we're on the Upper East Side, home of the pedophiles.
Yeah. Is Epstein's place near here?
It's about five blocks up.
And then somebody, our colleague, I'm Bill McCuddy. Our colleague, we're talking about the Jeffrey Epstein pedophile thing where he said he was comparing him to Hannibal Lecter. And I said, Hannibal Lecter, did he eat these kids?
Yeah, I read that tweet.
And I did hashtag try the veal. So I got a lot of hate mail for that. Look, this is an interesting topic to talk about because that's going to be a movie. There's no way the Jeffrey Epstein story is not going to be a movie.
Everything's a movie, man.
Yeah.
But
and then Aziz Ansari will be doing jokes about him, too.
All the criminals live on the Upper East Side.
You were near Madoff here, right?
Madoff was around the corner, and I mean, really?
It's white-collar
crime. How have you escaped the
city?
Law this long? We're at Neil Rosen's apartment this week because I moved out of the city
of
the
Hamptons.
That's
right, so we will no longer be doing the podcast from Bill McCuddy's place across the street from Carnegie Hall. So we're going to be doing it at my place, which is good. You know, at least we have the air conditioner running in this sweltering day. But anyway, yeah, so apparently I was reading Twitter, and they're saying Aziz is back, and... He, I wonder if he'll do a show.
Well, we've been hearing about Louis C.K. dropping into the Comedy Cellar and dropping into some other places, and it's been reported that he's been getting laughs. He's been talking a little bit about Me Too, but mostly trying to get his career back. And so Aziz, who's always been very upfront about...
But the Aziz situation is different. What he was accused of
Well,
is,
Aziz was ridiculous. That was a date
than
bad.
Louis C. Right. I forgot. What's the one? Ashley Banfield? Is that the CNN anchor?
MSNBC.
Okay. So, yeah, when the Aziz thing came out, she went on a whole tirade about yelling at the woman, saying exactly what you said, Bill, that that's not a Me Too thing. That's a bad date. And she said, and you're, to this woman addressing
you're screwing
camera,
up the movement.
You're ruining the movement.
Right.
Because... You know, you're taking advantage of something where there were serious concerns from serious people, you know, people that have like...
I had a ruined movement this morning. But that was her point. Everyone's allowed to say somebody acted inappropriately with me, but to jump on the Me Too bandwagon with that story. So Aziz was... I thought there was a very long piece in the Hollywood Reporter, if I recall the time.
He's very conciliatory about it. He said that
he came clean about the whole thing, and it really did just sound like he was a little aggressive with her. And wrong signals?
So, do you think he's back in terms of you think the before any of this happened with Aziz, he said he was done doing the. Show Master of None anyway. So, you know, if he wanted to come back and do another season. So I don't know. Do you think he can, you know, do movies, do TV shows?
I think the success of this Netflix special will be the first kind of indicator. Yeah.
Barometer of what's going on. Yeah. Well, Louis C.K. to address that, he came back. And then if you look, when he came back and made appearances at numerous comedy clubs. And I actually watched one of the sets. Somebody videotaped it. Jesus, I'm using terms from like 15 years ago. Somebody took their phone and recorded the thing. And it was like a...
Was it in color?
Yes, it was
Grandpa?
In color. It was in color. And it was about 30-some-odd minute set. And I listened to it. And right out of the box, he said, I've had the worst year I've ever had, blah, blah, blah.
You had to. Like when Pee Wee Herman, remember that? Pee Wee Herman did the VH1 Movie Awards million years ago after he got caught masturbating in a porno. And he goes,
so what's been happening when I was gone? Or what's new?
Or something like that. Well, I mean, you got to get out in front of it.
Well, the Louis thing, the Twitter lit up and they were like, not just too soon. It was just like, go away, don't ever come back. Nobody's doing that with Aziz Ansari.
Not that we're aware of.
But Louis C.K. thing was just like, who do you think you are coming back? And, you know, so that was not, people were not, he did not get a good welcome back. Nor did Charlie Rose, who tried to do a, he tried to get a whole bunch of people that were, men that were accused of doing things.
Stern was talking about that
this
morning.
And that was really, that was pathetic.
How wrong-headed that was.
Yeah, right. So, I don't know. So we'll see what happened with Aziz. In any event, last time we did the podcast, I watched this Roger Ailes, an episode and a half of this Roger Ailes documentary called...
Not a documentary.
Drama.
The Loudest Voice.
The Loudest Voice.
Based on a book by Gabe Sherman.
Right, and I checked in with my opinion. I thought Russell Crowe was amazing, but Bill McCuddy had not seen it. And since Bill McCuddy worked for Fox News for how many years?
I worked for Roger Ailes for 15 years.
Right, and he
Fox
hired
News
you.
For 12.
He hired
you. I won a contest. He was the judge, along with Al Roker and Dick Cavett. And
now, what kind of
Maury
contest?
And,
I saw that Seinfeld episode. What kind of contest was that?
It was not that kind of contest. We had to send a tape in, and then we went to 30 Rock. We went to Studio 8H, where they did Saturday Night Live. And Ed McMahon was the host, and I...
Hey, now!
20 people flown in from around the country. I thought I was going to come in second. I did not want to win. I had a great job in Washington, D.C., in an ad agency.
Want to win?
No, I wanted to go and be a part of it. I brought a documentary film crew, and I had a reporter with me from the Baltimore Sun, and I wanted it to be like this I came in second event, and then I won, and it changed my whole life. In 2 weeks, I had a television show. But Roger Ailes was my boss. He picked me. He was my agent. He said, someday you're going to have this is embarrassing because it didn't happen, but he said, someday, just like Letterman, you're going to have your own theater on Broadway or in New York. We could do a late night show with you and blah, blah, blah.
Was he wrong?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. I want to ask you something. With Ailes, you know, if you watch the first episode, just the way he plucked you from pretty much obscurity, you know, you watch and he's like, let's put this guy Sean Hannity on the air. This guy was painting houses a few months ago. You know what I mean?
Right.
He has no experience on television.
And let's get a stand-up comic and Combs to put him. Alan's perspiring. Should we put makeup on him? And Ailes is like, no, I like to see him sweat.
Right, Alan Combs. The guy's a comic. He's good. He's good. He offsets the other guy. But neither of these guys had any experience doing this.
Well, look, let's get a couple of things up. I'm going to evaluate it as objectively as I can. I think Russell Crowe is doing a great job as Roger Ailes. He's got the limp, the walk, the gait of the guy. The voice, he said he's gone on record saying he's not even really trying to sound like him. He doesn't sound like him, but he looks like him. Sienna Miller is doing an unbelievable job as his wife, Beth Tilson, who was really my day-to-day boss as opposed to Roger Ailes, who I saw once a week or twice a week. But Beth at America's Talking, the network is now MSNBC, that you came on as a guest of a couple of times.
Many times. I also came on.
I couldn't stop it. They seemed to keep booking
you.
You were the only
name
one
of the
that
show
would come
to something to. Else. Or
Wake
something.
Up America.
I don't know. There was a few. They sent a car for me and they sent me out to Jersey.
He'll go anywhere in a car. So remember that if you have candy. But I just want to point out that, you know, I look like a company guy. I was very disappointed with the way Roger Ailes' career ended. I don't think that's the note anybody wants to leave anything on. But I have to say that except for the portrayal of... I was in some of the meetings that are portrayed in this thing. The
really?
Only thing they kind of get wrong is they make this guy, Chet Collier, who was also a boss of mine, seem a little feeble, and he wasn't. He's a smart guy. And the other thing, just from a visual standpoint, is, yeah, Fox News's newsroom was underground, so there were no door, there were no windows, there were doors. But it was a much more lively, fun, interesting place to be than the kind of Machiavellian dark room that they're portraying
the depiction
on Showtime.
On Showtime is not a fun place.
Right.
But it was actually...
Yeah, it was great. It was great. I mean,
when you moved over to Fox from MSNBC, which is what Roger Ailes did, you know, I was on your show on that one, and I came up to your offices, And yeah, I remember you were next to, like, O'Reilly's office was in the corner.
Right.
And you
shared Judith Regan was next door to me.
Somebody else. And yeah, it didn't seem like a dour. The offices had windows. The offices, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that was not a below ground. And I remember, yeah, that I'm not saying that everybody was like laughing it up, but it didn't seem like, oh God, I'm walking into some really like
yeah, they make
funeral,
it look like Hitler's bunker on Showtime, and it was not Hitler's bunker. You know, that's a small detail. I think the broad strokes, it's getting right. Sure, it's a little one-sided, but I will tell you that I was asked to be a consultant on this series, and I turned that down. I was asked also by Gabe Sher. I just didn't want to piss on Roger's grave, but I was asked many, many, many times to cooperate with Gabe Sherman's book. He called me almost weekly for a year, and I refused to. I knew it was going to be a hit job. I'm not saying Roger was a great guy. He was a great boss to me. He never made a pass at me, which is unfortunate. I could use the $1 million, but he was a good guy to me, and so I knew the
way. Until he fired you.
No, well. Dude, that wasn't really his decision, actually. It was a committee of people that just decided not to pick my contract up for one more year. He actually gave me 3 years, and it lasted two. And then they made me a consultant for a huge amount of money for a year. So I really have no gripe there. I want everybody to know I got no ill will. So I would maybe love to see this thing come after him with a blow, you know, like Frankenstein, like the townspeople. It's clear that this is very, very, very heavily researched, and a lot of the details are right in it. And so I'm enjoying it. I will tell you that Mrs. McCuddy, who watched the first two episodes with me, was kind of like, this is much more for you than it is for America. And people that work there. And also Roger Friedman, who was at 411 as a colleague of ours, has been watching the ratings of this thing, and he says nobody's watching it. So despite the fact that
it's
got some huge
inside
names
baseball.
In it.
I mean, for you, it's super inside baseball because you work there. But for me and Bill Bregoli.
Well, you watch it more? You've
yeah,
seen two
I'm,
and a half episodes or whatever.
Well, yeah, I've just been busy. How many are there in total?
I think seven. You're hooked
well,
in.
Well, I'm very interested in, you know, as you.
I don't think you're in it. I know
I'm
you're
interested.
On a lot, but I don't think you're in it.
What's that?
I don't think you're in it. I know you were on the air.
No, I mean, I'm.
I worked with Bill O'Reilly for a morning.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He did radio for Westwood One, who I worked for. And he asked me to get him a sandwich downstairs. And he's very specific.
How did that go?
Well, it was very specific. It was a grilled cheese sandwich cut in 8 pieces. And the idea was that they're in little slivers. And while he's doing radio, he can just slide a little sliver in his mouth.
Right.
So and you actually went to a coffee shop and said, please.
I went to the cafeteria downstairs.
And said, please slice
it
up. And
they knew it was for Bill?
No. Actually, he didn't usually work out of our studios.
Oh.
But the cooks there are very acclimate. They're used to all sorts of strange requests. They had no problem. And then once he found out that I'm from Boston originally, he asked me all the people I worked for there and how much money they were paid. He wasn't interested in how they were doing. Just how much. They really pay that guy $1 million a year.
What's interesting is they have different actors playing, like, so there's an O'Reilly in the newsroom,
Steve Ducey,
and then they show,
there's
and there's
Hannity.
A Ducey, and then they show the real guys on, they're using clips of the real O'Reilly in places, which I'm not sure, I don't know how they got the rights to do that. I mean, obviously they vetted it all, but like, they've got a lot of people in this series who don't want to be in it.
Well,
and I'll tell you, the woman who plays Judy, Roger Ailes' assistant, looks exactly like her. In fact, a lot of the people look like the real thing. The Bill Shine guy
looks
like
Bill Shine.
Well,
they try to do that. I mean, Bill Bregoli and I were friends and sort of mentored by a woman who, by the name of Denise Oliver. Hi, Denise, if you're listening to this. Who is the woman who put Howard Stern and Robin Quivers together in a station in Washington, D.C. And she's depicted in the movie Private Parts.
By Allison Janney.
And... yeah, and I don't know. Do you think,
I thought she got her great.
Do you think
I really
that
did.
She captured Denise
she
Oliver?
She did.
From a look perspective or just from the...
Well, they built up the bust and that worked.
Yeah. Well, that's what Howard said to me when I interviewed him for that movie. He goes, I go, I'm friends with Denise. And that's exactly, that was his first reference. He goes, oh, Denise, what a para, you know? And I'm like, oh, geez.
Howard.
You know I mean, like that was his reference.
He's been talking about that movie this week. And did you know there were 21 versions of that script before Ivan Reitman called him and said, I've read your book and here's what the script should be. And he took 5 minutes and Howard went, that's exactly what the script should be. And so Ivan became the producer. He got him Betty Thomas, who had just done a thing called Late Night, right, which was Bill Carter's book about Leno and Letterman. And he said, that's the feel you want. And Howard was like, yeah, that is the feel I want. And now here we are.
Yeah. Well, to answer your question, I am interested in continuing to watch this, but I like backstage television stuff. I liked Late Night, the Mindy Kaling, Emma Thompson movie, as we talked about in a previous podcast. I like this. I like stuff that goes. I like that movie Late Night, the other Late Night movie that you just mentioned about the late night wars between Letterman and Leno. I mean, I like and that's a great book, by the way.
It is a great book. Bill Carter.
But then he did a sequel.
Leno hiding in the bathroom and listening to.
Yeah, but then he did a sequel to that book when Conan got the Tonight Show for like a minute. Leno stole it back. So there's another book that comes out.
Rigoli, have you seen any of this Roger Ailes thing on Showtime?
No.
And it doesn't interest you?
It doesn't for political reasons.
Right.
I hate Fox so much.
Well, I'm with you.
My wife's watching the thing and going, how did you work for this asshole? He's just so evil. And I'm like, he wasn't evil to me. And, well, anyway, that's my take on it. I'm going to stay with it till the end, but I understand that America may not be, and what a huge money loser for Showtime, because they paid everybody scale except, my understanding, except
Russell,
who I think got like $10 million for it.
But is there any name in this? Think about it, other than Russell Crowe.
Sienna Miller's not a name?
Oh, Sienna Miller, that's true. I'm so sorry. Sienna Miller.
And the woman, Annabeth Wallace, who's playing the one he had the longest
affair
with.
Gretchen,
Seth MacFarlane's in it.
Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. And
there's
and
a lot of names.
Who plays Gretchen Carlson?
Naomi Watts.
Naomi Watts. Yeah, so there are a lot of. So they all got scale?
Yeah.
Wow.
Allegedly.
Interesting.
I will tell you one quick story, which is kind of cool, which was told to me by a Teamster who was working on the show, that oftentimes during the making of the show, Russell Crowe would say, this is bullshit, this is too far over the top. And one time was they went into a diner. So we were across the street from a diner called the Red Oak, and so was CNBC in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And Roger would go over there and have meetings because it was he liked to get out of the building and he liked to have a sandwich. So he would go in. Apparently, they tried to shoot a scene where the table is filled with food, just filled with he orders everything on the menu.
He was obese.
Yeah, he is a big guy. Also a hemophiliac, and that's what killed him eventually.
He was a hemophiliac?
Yeah, that's what he died of.
Oh.
He bled out.
Oh.
So didn't you see him with the bloody nose thing where he kept for like he had like handfuls of tissue were bloody. Anyway,
okay.
Russell Crowe walked in and said, "This is bullshit. This is way too much food. I'm not doing this scene. You're piling it on too deep." And so apparently Russell, which is one of the other reasons they reached out to me, apparently Russell Crowe felt like the script was a little one side, not fair and balanced. So he wanted some. He's made some changes creatively in it. My friend Joe Cortese is in it. He's in episode 7, I think. The guy who was in the Green Book, whose hat gets stolen in the beginning of the movie by Vigo.
We should mention, in fairness to you, that what you did on Fox News was completely non-political. And
yeah, I used to say I cover stage left and stage right.
Right, you were
and
covering.
And Tim Robbins gave me the finger on the red carpet because I mean I was
you were covering
associated with
you
Fox.
You were covering entertainment,
yeah.
And the reports that you were doing could have easily been on MSNBC or anything. I mean, and I remember people gave you a lot. Like I remember we would do junkets and people would come up to you and say like, "How could you work with Fox News?" And you were like, you know, I don't subscribe to their politics.
Right.
Just doing junkets.
If you'll remember, I did Hard News for a year and a half because one of your friends who was a producer watched me from MSNBC and was like, "My God, he's okay at that." But it drove me nuts. I really didn't want to drink the Kool-Aid there. And
well, who would blame me not to?
Ultimately, the reason
I
didn't stay.
That crap.
All right. So, yes, I recommend it. Bill's Politics won't let him watch it, which I think is probably true of a lot of people listening to this now.
Well, my politics is also, I didn't want to watch it for that reason, but like Bill Bregoli. But again, I'm just interested in the portrayal of this guy who was a sexual predator and a mess, and you know, but kind of like had a vision, and the vision was successful from a rating standpoint and a monetary standpoint, and that interests me. Bill McCuddy sent us all an article to read, and it's kind of very interesting, and it's about the state of the summer movie season this year, and it goes back all the way to the 60s. And
it's Todd McCarthy, probably one of the premier critics working right now.
Yes, he used to be the critic for Variety, and now he works for The Hollywood Reporter, and he looks at five decades from the 60s on, 1969, 79, 89, 99, 2000.
Right.
Actually, that would be six years, and how the summer movie season has changed. And if you look at what was released in 1969, you look at this article, or even, you know, 79, it starts to change, but you still had some.
Well, the important thing, the way he sets it up before we go backwards, is that, like, this is kind of a shitty summer so far. I mean, there's a lot of franchise stuff.
Everything's tanking.
Yeah, and I had forgotten about some of these movies. They came and went so quickly. John Wick Chapter 3, which is not a bad movie.
It made some money when it opened, but it came and went.
Which you liked, Bill Bregoli. Yeah.
Parabellum, Aladdin. Remember, Aladdin was going to be the big thing that Will Smith was going to, you know, this
had
whole...
It legs for a couple of weeks, but didn't
gone.
Break records,
Godzilla,
yeah.
Dark Phoenix, The Secret Life of Pets 2, Men in Black International. How could that fail? Well, said for a long time...
Well, you didn't have Tommy
time,
Lee Jones and Will Smith.
And
you had Hemsworth.
It's called Men in Black, and it's got a woman as one of the leads. I'm not trying to be sexist, but it was weird. The new Shaft, which I finally caught up with that you two love, or you didn't love.
I liked it.
But it was okay.
I thought it was very fun.
I thought it was dopey and bad. Annabelle Comes Home, Child's Play, Spider-Man. Spider-Man Far From Home is making some money.
That's doing fine.
And, of course, The Lion King is going to make money.
Well,
but,
you know, wouldn't it be interesting? According to Todd McCarthy, I don't think, he was that thrilled with the movie. And wouldn't it be interesting if it does not become the, as you've been predicting all year, that that's going to become the big blockbuster movie. If it does not make...
Lion King, you're talking about.
If it does not make the money that it's, you know, that people are thinking it's going to make. You know, Meal Yesterday's making more money than people thought it was going to make, the movie Yesterday.
Yeah.
But, wouldn't that be interesting if it's not the... box office bonanza.
I think it's going to, and here's why. I think it really this year is proving it more than ever. The movies are now an all or nothing proposition. There's almost no middle ground. You're either a huge hit or nobody's going to see you. There's nothing in between. So I think movies like Lion King will prove that people come out in droves for the right product, but they stay home in droves for everything else. Well, because as we said last week or 2 weeks ago, that interesting article in the New York Times, a guy said millennials don't go to the movies,
they go to a movie. Well, according to this Todd McCarthy article in The Hollywood Reporter, he also was talking about the death of the movie theater. I mean, it seems to be that everybody's talking about the death of the movie theater. Now, I know a guy who's very good friends with a friend of mine who owns a big chain of movie theaters and Bowtie Cinemas. And I saw my friend over the weekend, and he said, you know, and I was talking about that article, and he said that this guy that we know says that he's doing really great with his movie theaters. His movie theaters used to be in New York. They're not so much in New York anymore. They're now in the middle of the country, but he changed his strategy. He put in the lazy boy chairs, you know, and he serves good food and everything, and people are coming to the movies.
Have you been to the one here at 61st?
No, I have not.
Okay.
I have not.
A friend of ours does the PR, and they invite me every week. So if there's a movie there you want to see, we should all go.
Well, apparently, he's doing all right. So maybe this death nail in the coffin of
yeah, but listen to what you just said. He had to completely change his business model. He had to bring in a chef. They had to get a liquor license. They had to, come on. I mean, that's saving the movie business?
I don't know.
Turning them into restaurants?
I don't know. You know, as long as you had that window, the window of, I want to see movie X, you know, or movie Y or movie Z, but I can't wait to see it on demand or DVD or HBO or whatever because it's, you know, I can't wait to see this movie, but it's not going to come on TV in some form or on a screen for 3 or 4 months.
But you know that window is getting smaller and smaller.
Right, so I'm saying as long as you had that window, then people went to the movies. But now, with Netflix, the window is kind of like not really that much around anymore. I mean, Netflix is releasing stuff straight to Netflix. I wonder what's going to happen with The Irishman. You know, I know your theory, Bill, about that they're going to release.
I talked to Roger Friedman about that, and he doesn't. To remind listeners, I think that with a six-hour film like The Irishman, they'll show the first 2 hours in a theater and then abruptly stop it, like Mannion of the Spring. Remember that 2 years ago?
I know.
Yeah, 25 years ago.
Well,
and you'll
John
have to
DeFloretta,
go.
John DeFloretta, Mannion of the Spring. It was a six-hour movie, and they I don't know what they did in France, but in America they broke it up into two movies. One
being we've
John
had Kill Bill 1 and 2. We've had a lot of films like that.
Well,
but
was
I
Kill
think,
Bill 1 and 2
I think this
made
is,
to be
I think
one
it would
movie?
Be genius on Netflix's part to have the first 2 hours in theaters that
but
would qualify
it. But Netflix doesn't give a shit about theaters. That's the whole thing.
No, but they own it. They'll get some. They'd get some of the proceeds, and then you'd have to go home and watch the other 4 hours, which you could do immediately.
But, you know, Bill Regoli, we all read that
but
article.
But wait, let me just tell you that the reason Friedman doesn't think that'll work is because now the rules have been changed in the Academy, and you have to be exclusively a theatrical release to be qualify for an Oscar, and they
so
won
which
Oscars.
One, which one would you,
they
which
won
one would you do?
They didn't win for Roma. Netflix is going to, if you thought we got a lot of Roma tchotchkes, and I'm staring across the room right now at
Roma
Neil
pillow.
Rosen's apartment at a Roma pillow.
Yeah, I didn't
the
ask
one man
for
who
it,
didn't
just...
throw it away. We're going to get, they're going to come and paint our houses.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to do. Every critic is going to get their house painted.
That's funny. Yeah, but if you look at these movies that came out in pre-decade, I mean, you know, like an... You know, I can't believe that Alien was 40 years ago, the original Alien. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that
that was 79, right?
That was 40 years ago that I saw Alien. But, you know, Apocalypse Now came out in 79 also. You know, and then, you know, I mean, I'm looking at the 79 list, you know. You had Monty Python's Life of Brian, and you had Meatballs, and you had a big Bond movie, Moonraker, which was kind of a bizarre kind of Bond movie. And you had The In-Laws, which was a great comedy with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. And, you know, and you even had Rocky too. You had a real mix of stuff. And now, you know, as you keep getting into deeper, closer to this decade.
Yeah, 10 years from now, this will look like a mix of stuff too. I mean, that list has a couple of franchises on it. Bond, the idea that it's all sequels this year is, it's an easy thing to say. I think the bigger statement is that they're all tanking. None of those movies tanked. 1979, everybody went to see Alien, Moonraker, everything you mentioned
look
was a hit.
Look at 69. You got The Wild Bunch, the Sam Peckinpah movie. Uh-huh. You've got True Grit, the John Wayne Glenn Campbell movie. I mean, you've got Easy Rider. You got Woody Allen's first real...
Bananas was in 69?
Take the Money and Run.
Take the Money
I mean,
and Run.
Unless you count What's Up Tiger Lily, which was...
For his crimes, Virgil is severely punished. He's placed in a hot box with an Allstate... insurance
Hi,
salesman.
I'm Sam Watson. I want to talk to you about your premium.
but original stuff isn't doing all that well now. I mean, they complain about the sequels. It had like something like
Booksmart.
Yeah, that's a shame because that's one of the best movies of the year, and I know Neil agrees with me. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood will be a test of whether or not original content is something people want to see this summer.
I don't know. Well, according to this article...
But is that original content... Because you're really going to see a Quentin Tarantino movie. It's almost a franchise.
Nah.
Yeah, it almost is. It's almost like going to see a Woody Allen movie. Remember in the 60s and 70s where you had to see the next Woody Allen movie?
Well, would that be like Alfred Hitchcock? Like I have to see the next Alfred Hitchcock film?
Maybe.
Or I have to see the next Billy Wilder film or something like that?
I understand it's a standalone movie, but I think people, it has the advantage of being something from someone
that
you want to see.
You could say that about any movie star. Or in, like I want to see the new Tom Cruise movie. I want to see the new Adam Sandler movie. I want to see the new.
I think the name Quentin Tarantino
Brad
opens
Pitt
a movie.
Well,
this isn't a new Brad Pitt movie.
Well, I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. You know that we did on the TV show. We talked about the movies we were most looking forward to this summer. What are you most looking forward to? Is it over? Is there anything you're looking forward to, Bill Bergoli, this summer?
No, actually,
nothing.
Not even the Tarantino movie, because I'm afraid he'll just without. Hate to say it, but without the genius of Harvey Weinstein to make him cut his damn script down, This thing's going to get really talky.
Did Harvey Weinstein have any input on The Hateful Eight, which I thought was one clinker in the canon of movies of Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah, I'm almost positive.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that one didn't...
That's not a clinker.
I wasn't that thrilled with it. It seemed like he was just trying to repeat...
And how long was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at Cannes? Was it 3 hours?
Yeah, it's pretty damn long from what I heard.
Yeah.
And then they said he was maybe going to make it longer.
So we talked about this last podcast.
Is he going to shoot it? Is he going to film? Is he going to show it in, remember, right, in different Hateful Eight? And
right. Fancy. Spectravision or whatever.
Yeah. Nah. Nah.
Some format.
There's going to be a Big Lebowski spinoff with John Turturro playing his Jesus character. Isn't that interesting? What do you know? I'm scrolling down.
Who's buying that?
I'm scrolling down on the article that you sent me, Bill, and to see the end of the article.
That's the next article.
Yeah. And the next article says the Jesus, you got to listen to the Jesus, if you remember.
That's
got
to be Amazon, Netflix, or Hulu.
I don't know, man.
I think it was a sort of a regular distributor.
Bobby Cannavale and Audrey Tautou will also star. The Jesus Rolls is the name of the film.
Okay.
All right. Turturro's reprising.
And that's a major motion picture for theatrical release?
Screen Media has picked up domestic rights with plans to release the movie in early 2020. Turturro wrote, directed, and stars in the film. So I guess not the Coen brothers.
That's unusual that he would. So what did he do? He went to the Coen brothers and said.
John Hamm, Susan Sarandon, and Pete Davidson also appear in the film.
Yeah, but let me ask you this: how did that get made? How did he get that?
Turturro's been in a lot of Coen brothers.
No, they're friendly. They're very friendly.
What was the one? Barton Fink. He's in a lot of stuff. So I'm sure he said, I'm sure they let him have the rights to spin off the thing.
You could throw a rock in there and hit a screenwriter. In fact, I wish you would. I mean, Michael Learned.
Turturro. Yeah, I need that part. I don't need you for that Barton Fink feeling. He says to Barton Fink. I can get anybody to get that Barton Fink feeling. I like that movie. But, Turturro's written and directed movies before, so they probably...
There have to be other examples of that where a star has gone to a writer or producer or director and said, I like my character. I want to spin it off. Tweet us about that.
Well, there's a lot of movies where there are sequels and the original people involved are not involved in the sequel. I mean, it's different writers.
But sadly, they got Richard Roundtree to come back to your Shaft, didn't they?
Yeah, well, he's in it for 10 minutes at the end there, But I you didn't like that film, Bill? I thought it was funny. And you didn't like it?
No, I thought it was
Was Usher in that? I forget.
Yeah, Usher was weak link. In the movie.
Jesse T.
But Jesse T. Usher. It is the Usher.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a different Usher.
He's very confused. He's very, very confused.
All right, anyway. I've been watching this thing on YouTube, which I had my colleagues here, Bill Bregoli and Bill McCuddy, watch.
Yeah, it was good because I needed a good night's sleep last night.
Yeah, well, The Hollywood Reporter, since we're speaking about this article in The Hollywood Reporter. Before we move on to that, Bill Bregoli, I want to ask you, do you think, I asked you this 2 weeks ago, but now that we've read this other article that Bill McCuddy sent us,
Do I think the movies are doomed?
Do you think the movies will be they will be theaters in 2029, 10 years from now? Do you think there will be a movie theater where there's be the communal experience where people will sit down with a group of 200 strangers?
Yeah, tickets will cost $32.
What do you
hope
think
he's wrong? No, I think there'll always be a place to go see them,
but they won't be cheap.
It won't be cheap, but no. And it won't be. It'll be spectacular stuff.
Yeah.
It'll have to be
big screen stuff.
3D. It'll have to be
Bond.
Something. Yeah, it'll have to be.
So it'll be like a handful of these. It won't be like.
I'm afraid so, yeah.
Listen, we're on the Upper East Side right now. If you used to walk down Third Avenue.
No one likes a bragger.
If you used to walk down Third Avenue, it still exists across from Bloomingdale. Cinema 1, it used to be Cinema 1 and 2. Now it's Cinema 1, 2, 3. But on the same block, you had the Baronet and the Coronet Theater. Gone. Around the corner on 59th Street, you had 1, 2, 3. You had like 4 theaters there. Then further down the block on 3rd Avenue, like 2 blocks down, you had another theater. You had the Sutton Theater.
We said this 2 weeks ago house on 7th Street, on 7th Avenue, was almost wall-to-wall movie theaters from Central Park all the way down to Times Square.
I know. So they all went away. So I'm saying in 10 years from now,
I think
an IMAX theater and maybe one or two of these plush things that you're like, I pick... where you can get food, drinks, and you can you know, relax.
The business model's changing. There's no question about it.
Real estate's tough.
There's going to be left. They're going to be fewer and fewer.
Yeah, sad. So anyway,
Starbucks needs more locations.
So the Hollywood Reporter does this series, and it just came out with it a couple of weeks ago. And I recommend it. There's two of them. It's a comedy actors roundtable and a comedy actress roundtable. The comedy actors roundtable, and this is pretty impressive. I mean, you've got...
They've been doing this for years, and they launched them around the Oscars, but they've been doing these roundtables
for
a long time.
Well, you've got Ted Danson, you've got Don Cheadle, you have Henry Winkler, you have Jim Carrey, and please forgive me, the guy who's in Veep.
Oh, yeah. What is his name? The guy from Veep.
Please forgive me, the guy from Veep. The misogynistic idiot. The character from Veep is in there. And, you know, it was like an hour and 15 minutes, but I thought it was very interesting. I mean, you know, the woman who was doing the moderating the panel, she moderates the actress one too, and I'll get to the actress one in a moment. I mean, you know, she kind of stayed in the background, which I liked. She asked a question and didn't really kind of interject herself that much and let them all kind of talk, which I thought was a good...
They're the dopey, finish this sentence, I do this because...
The questions were a little arch.
We were talking before the podcast, Bill McCuddy, you were saying that you're getting a little tired of this Jim Carrey.
Well, Jim Carrey's on some kind of transcendental meditation level of I've been Jim Carrey and I'm a little embarrassed by it. I'm very insecure. I need attention.
I'm
we all do.
Said, I'm in pieces.
Sacha Baron Cohen was in this thing too, and you forgot to mention
Sacha
him.
Baron Cohen. I love Sacha Baron Cohen. You're right.
And they're all sort of paying homage to each other. But the shtick of I'm Jim Carrey and I've looked into my navel more completely than you've looked into yours is getting kind of old for me.
Of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. And I watched a lot of those, not all of them. And again, he was in this Zen kind of Buddhist mood of like, well, you know, I was craving this fame at one point and now... Fame is immaterial.
You know who else was exactly like that but wore it better and would remember to also be funny when he was on Jerry Seinfeld's show? Yeah.
Steve Martin?
No. Well, Martin would fall sort of into that category. No, Gary Shandling was like very much in tune with the Zen of everything. Gary in fact, they called it the Zen Diaries when they made an HBO special about it.
I'll tell you a Gary Shandling story. Gary Shandling loved me. He really did. He hated it. Yeah. He did not like to do interviews.
And lucky for you, he's dead and can't really confirm this.
Well, when he came to New York to promote stuff, he would only do 3 or 4 interviews. And God knows what. I was such a fan of the Larry Sanders Show. I thought it was the greatest. I still think it's the greatest behind-the-scenes look at a talk show.
How's my hair?
He's great. So I conveyed that to Gary early on, and he just always wanted to do interviews with me. So we had an interview once. It was like 40 minutes. And he was promoting. They had a Larry Sanders.
And Bill and I know what kind of torture that is because we do this with you every week.
So they had like a 25. He released a Larry Sanders compilation disc. It wasn't the entire series. It was kind of the best of Larry Sanders. And then he did these extras where he
showed up at Sharon Stone's house.
Yes, exactly.
And like
exactly.
A lot of things like that. And and they're kind of bizarre.
So we talk.
They're kind of weird.
So we talk and let's
in
say,
a cool way.
So 40 minute interview, whatever it is. So 20 minutes, 25 minutes in, it's terrible. The interview's terrible. All he's talking about is, you know, being on a higher plane and just, you know, being, you know, all this Buddhist kind of stuff. But, you know, I'm polite and I'm just listening. I mean, I'm honored that Gary Shandling is granting me this interview.
You were polite that day?
25 minutes into it, he looks at me and he goes, I'm not really giving you anything here good, am I? To your point of like, you know, and I just started laughing. And then he just became comedian Gary Shandling. And he became very funny. But he realized that he was rambling on about this stuff that just, not really usable. And if usable, not really entertaining at all. That nobody really wants to listen to this, certainly, you know.
Right.
And then he just, a button went off in his head and he, you know, and boom, he just became like, Tonight Show guest Gary Shandling,
right.
You know, and it was terrific. So,
a little too much of Zen Jim Carrey for me.
Yeah.
Sacha Baron Cohen, who I find brilliant, was okay, but not amazing.
Well, he told a story that I've heard before because I interviewed him for that, and I talked all about, you know, going undercover as Borat or Bruno and all that. And so, again, I'm privy to that, but he was kind of talking about that same thing, about it's an adrenaline rush. He likes the feeling of, am I going to get caught and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, it was a lot of ass. They were all kissing each other's ass a little
kinda.
Bit, you know?
Whereas the women I found, I mean, you put Jane Fonda next to Taraji P.
Yeah,
Henson.
Let's go. Right, yeah, Jane Fonda, Taraji P. Henson, Natasha Lyonne, who else?
Who's crazy, by the way. I hear from more people. Yeah. She seemed
but
like
Russian
she was
Doll
sedate.
Russian Doll is such a good show. Did you ever watch Russian Doll?
Nah, I couldn't get through more than three. She's nuts, according to someone that
I don't know. I've met her. I think she's kind of nice, but all right.
Well, anyway, you get Jane Fonda next to Taraji P. Henson, and you got, you know, Jane was kind of the Jim Carrey of the female round table in that she was, you know, feels like she's been around longer, sure. which she has, and she doesn't have the comedic chops that some of the other people had.
The women. I do comedy because.
Yeah, that's the kind of questions
right. And
you
Jane Fonda
here.
Goes, because I get to work with Lily Tomlin.
Yeah,
and, somebody
and then
else,
everybody goes, oh, nice.
Somebody
I want
else
to.
Goes, I wish I could work. Then yeah. so you had Al.
And then Jane Fonda goes, of course you do.
See, yeah. So you had the woman who plays the agent manager on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I think
yeah, but
Alex Borstein.
Borstein.
She also was the voice on of the wife on Family Guy.
And she was on Mad TV.
Yeah, man. She played the.
You look like a man.
Yeah, she was.
You look
she played
like
the
a man.
The Asian
Miss Swan.
Yeah,
she my daughter
funny on,
loved that.
She was very funny. On, she's very talented.
You can't do that character anymore, though. Think about Mad TV and that.
She lives
Miss
in Barcelona,
Swan.
And she's saying that like, and everybody's like, oh, nice. When you know, and she goes, I didn't want to do this Maisel thing, but what's the name of the woman? Paladino.
Gail Paladino.
No, something Paladino.
Claudia.
Begged her to do the thing, and she goes, so I did it. Now I live in Barcelona. I'm back in Barcelona, you know. But they were pretty all-star panels. Both
yeah, the women were more interesting to me. And I just thought that I learned more to make Lisa Rossman very happy.
Yeah, okay. Well, I kind of recommend
that. I really
that.
Did.
I don't know.
Those roundtables have been around. Remember when there was a Peter Bart and Peter Goober television show on the Sundance Channel
yes.
on Sunday morning?
Yes, it was called Shootout or something like that.
Yeah,
what?
Sunday Morning Shootout or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those
yeah.
were great.
Well, you know what
nobody
I
nobody watched, though. Well, I'm saying that those were a half an hour long, and then they would do a roundtable show.
Do you remember the one, Bill Bergoli? This was my favorite. John Favreau did...
No, he did. That was its own series.
It was a series.
Dinner with,
and he would have like...
He's doing something similar to that
four people or five famous people, and they'd have dinner.
They'd go to a restaurant.
Eating a
Burt
meal.
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah. But great stories. I mean, they were just great. Like, Burt Reynolds would tell you, you know, when I was shooting, you know, Deliverance... John Voight was such a, you know, he was just great stories. I mean, you know, so.
So somebody, did Lonnie Anderson write a book this week that came out that's trashing Burt? Because they
oh,
were
really?
Talking about it on Howard Stern the other day.
Well, you know, it's really easy
control
to write.
Freak, pinched her when she was talking to other men.
Huh. Well, they like, weren't they married?
Yeah, but she didn't want to meet anybody that she'd ever been with.
I don't know. It
might not be Lonnie Anderson. I don't know who it was.
Well.
But somebody's written a book about it.
You know, it's bad when you write a book about somebody when they're gone and they can't respond to the thing. Like this guy, Bushkin, who was Johnny Carson's lawyer,
yeah.
you know, with Joan Rivers, you know, they were going to do a play about it, actually, wrote this
right.
scathing book about Johnny Carson. You know, but Bushkin wouldn't do this when Johnny was around. I mean, you know, the book comes out after Johnny's gone, and it's like,
well,
Johnny's a prick, Johnny's a bastard. You know, the only time he's
guess
nice
guess who was going to play Ed McMahon in that play?
Who? You?
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Put you in a fat suit?
I know who thank you very much.
No,
I know the producers.
That is complimentary. You're thank not you. The weight of Ed McMahon.
You are correct, sir.
Hey, now.
I actually went up and did it at Caroline's one night. I wore a suit and like did a little Ed, and they were like, yes,
that's
you got
it. That's the genius of Phil Hartman in that imitation. You know, Dana Carvey, who was doing Johnny Carson, had, you know, 98% of the dialogue. And if not 99% of the dialogue. But what do you remember? All you remember is Phil Hartman, who just
goes
and goes, yes, you are correct, sir. Ha, ha, ha. Hey-o. You know, I mean, that is the genius of Phil Hartman.
I was very friendly with Ed. He called me every year on my birthday.
No.
Because it was also his birthday, he thought.
I'll tell you something interesting. You know, when the Tonight Show first started, and before my time, really, apparently it was, you know,
the
I remember when it was 90 minutes before it was an hour. But it was actually an hour and 45 minutes. And the first 15 minutes...
didn't go national.
...was right. And Johnny would come out and do the monologue for the first year of the show, and the rest of the country wouldn't see the monologue. So Johnny, when he started getting a little more power and clout, he goes, this is bullshit. You know, I'm not coming on until all the affiliates are online.
I want everyone to see the first 15
right.
minutes.
But so what they did is, and it's on YouTube, you can watch it. There is the first 15 minutes was Ed and before Doc Severinsen. Doc Severinsen was in the band, but he wasn't
Skitch Henderson.
Skitch Henderson. They would do 15 minutes, and throughout the 15, you know, they would talk to the audience. Tell me what you did today, Skitch. Well, you know, I went out and I had a bagel. You know, the bagels here in New York.
Like,
you know,
Regis and Kelly.
It's just bullshit. And every couple of minutes, Ed would go, Johnny will be here in a couple of minutes. We're waiting for Johnny. And they'd open the show with the theme, you know, dun 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 dun. And then, you know, and then at 11:30, they'd start the whole thing all over again with the same da 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 theme, and then here's Johnny. But it was this ludicrous 15 minutes right. of just, you know, I see you got a new trumpet
kind of like the 15 minutes we're in right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But it's online. You could go to YouTube and just Google Johnny, the Tonight Show 1965 or something like that.
When are we seeing, speaking of 1965, when are we seeing the 1969 Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Well, I spoke to the studio yesterday, and they...
didn't hang up on you this time?
They will be having screening shortly, and we're going to do it for our next episode of our TV show. We're kind of... You know, it's interesting. Usually when we get to the dog days of August, and we're in the first week of July right now, or the second week of July, you know, I mean, what's left, really? What is left? I mean, in terms of, like, big blockbuster bullshit movies... You mentioned the Disney, a thing that you think is going to, like, bring down the house.
Lion King?
Yeah. I mean, other than that, I mean, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, what
else? I don't think anybody thinks Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is going to be a huge blockbuster.
What's the next big... Is Midsommar doing well at the box office?
It actually, for genre and independent, that sort of thing, it did break records, yeah.
Okay.
So that's per screen average, though, right?
Screen-wise, it's only in 2,700 theaters or something right. like that. Yeah, it did actually do well.
So that's, for people who don't know, a creepy kind of Norwegian
same director.
Amway meeting.
It's a remake of an old...
Is it?
I believe it is.
No, I don't think
so. I don't think so.
Okay.
It reminds some people of other films, like Straw Man and stuff like that, but it's...
Well, these people go on a vacation to, like,
Sweden.
I've got a friend in
Sweden, but they filmed it in Hungary.
And yes, they have weird practices in the yeah, and it's supposed to be interesting. Although I didn't
same guy who did Hereditary, same director.
Right.
Okay. Well,
so it has that vibe.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I'm dying to see that. I'm going to see that this week in the Hamptons.
2 hours and 20 minutes. It's long.
My.
Ooh.
Yeah, my.
2:40, something like that.
How's Toy Story 4 doing?
Good.
Yeah.
Very well.
Okay. Well, you know.
Better than it should for the derivative plot, the repetitive scenes.
Well, in that article that you liked, the guy, Todd McCarthy, liked it, and I liked it. I said it's no Toy Story 3, and I still like your line. At the end of the movie, Bill McCuddy texted me, he was somewhere else in the theater, and he goes, stick a forky in it or put a forky in it, we're done. You know
it's
what
over.
I mean? And I think we're done here.
Yeah. Wow.
Hey, thanks for listening.
What do we do here every week, Bill McCuddy?
We watched, although we didn't get to many this week, we watched the bad movies so you don't have to.
What's coming out next week, Bill
McCuddy? Just one movie, and that is Lion King.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about that. We're all going to
see that. Oh, yeah, I'll be there tomorrow.
We're all going to see that, and we're all seeing that tomorrow, and we will talk about that next week. We'll have a lengthy discussion. And
you ever in the car and the tank is clearly on empty? Here we are right now.
Reach me at Neil Rosenell Apples on Twitter.
I'm at Bill McCuddy on Twitter.
And on Instagram. Yay.
And on Instagram, Bill Bregoli.
That's right.
Bill Bregoli. Have you been putting any pictures up?
I have.
What are we?
Jeffrey Epstein?
The Jeffrey Epstein production?
Yeah, I'd like to. No, I had actually had a little tchotchke that somebody gave me. It's a snow globe with Alfred E. Newman in it.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw that.
Oh, by the way, rest in peace, Mad Magazine, before we go.
Yeah, I guess.
But no, who was reading it anyway?
No. I was, at the end, nobody. But, like, I was definitely influenced by that.
Totally.
I sent them something they used, so I was, like, very sad.
Bill Bregoli wrote for National Lampoon, which was, I think, the adult version of
And cornered one of the guys from Mad and said, do some of my song parodies.
And they told, said, no.
Would you agree, Bill Brigoli, that National Lampoon could not have happened without Mad Magazine?
Oh, yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mad Magazine influenced me more than I can words could even say. But I will say that who even knew where to get a copy of Mad Magazine lately? Who was reading it in the end, you know?
I don't know.
So, but they're gone.
Also, they moved them to L.A., and that didn't help.
Yeah. Well, Bill Gaines, William.
Yeah,
Gaines.
Well, he sold them, and D.C. Got them, and D.C. became part of Warner. I worked in the same building they were in. That's why I got to talk to them at 1700 Broadway here in the city. And they had the most beautiful archives you ever saw. They had this room that was temperature controlled where they had
every issue.
Yeah, and I asked them why, and they said, well, particularly for DC Comics, if they wanted to see what a certain superhero or character was wearing because they're doing a flashback to a certain thing in the 50s, they could go back.
Attention to detail.
That's right.
Where are the craftspeople now?
I know. Well, again, they moved to LA, and who knows what happened to that nice air conditioned room.
Well, bye bye, Mad Magazine. Bye bye, Alfred E. Newman, and bye bye, audience.
Yeah, we're done.
What us for, worry
for today for this week? And we'll thanks for sitting around talking movies with us this week, and we'll sit around talking movies again with you next week.